I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Heart and Circ. Allow me to introduce you to Tommy Martin, a trainee in Jonathan Kirk's lab at Loyola University Chicago, who is scheduled to defend his thesis in October. As an associate editor at AJP Heart and Circ and a founding member of this Behind the Bench podcast crew, Jonathan is always on the lookout for a good backstory. So he suggested we talk with Tommy, who prefers Tommy over Tom, or the much more formal Thomas, because that would be his grandfather. Tommy is the first author on a recently published manuscript that appeared in AJP Heart and Circ in May on BAG3 expression and sarcomere localization in the human heart are linked to HSF1 and are differentially affected by sex and disease. Tommy has a cool story that we think will resonate with trainees and early career researchers. He was vacillating between going to med school and getting a PhD when he interviewed at Loyola University Chicago with Jonathan. That interview was the deciding factor to take the fork in the road that led to grad school for PhD and training in Jonathan's lab, where Tommy learned how to use a pipette for the first time. Would-be med students, am I right? Just kidding. 4 years and a lot of pipetting later, by the way, I may have just made up that word, pipetting, Tommy is now interviewing for postdoc positions, aka life beyond the Kirk lab. He is engaging, sharp, and clearly a rising star in cardiovascular sciences. I think you'll enjoy our conversation with him, so let's get at it.
Hi, Tommy. Welcome to the pod. So exciting to have you here. This was much hyped on our part to have one of Jonathan's trainees. And I got to say, as the Jonathan 2.0, I feel like a bit of a supervisor to you in starting this conversation, which is really not warranted at all. So to get to know you as my trainee of sorts, tell us a bit about yourself, Tommy. You know, where are you right now? How did you come to be in that lab? And especially, how did you come to choose this wonderful world of academia over the very enticing world of medicine and everything that led you to sort of this paper here?
Yeah, thank you, Charlotte. I guess where I'm at right now is I'm a fourth year PhD student in Jonathan's lab. Maybe I'm a fifth year now, just started my fifth year, getting ready to defend and go on to do a postdoc. But yeah, if you go back a few years to when I was deciding on what to do, as was mentioned, I was kind of going between medical school and graduate school. And for the longest time, it was just the medical school route that was my interest. So in undergrad, I was a pre-med student. And then I started interviewing at medical schools and I wasn't loving it, but I was telling myself, this is what you're going to do. This is what you told everyone you're going to do. And it wasn't so much the case. I was having reservations. So at the same time as I was interviewing, I also put in an application to a few schools for my PhD, having basically no bench research, no basic science research experience. My background, having had the med school in mind, was very clinical in research background. I came to Loyola, my interview here. Jonathan was the first person I spoke with. So he was the first interview I had in a day of interviews. And at that time, like everything at Loyola just felt very natural. Everyone was very welcoming. And I was pretty set after leaving that interview that I was going to go to graduate school. And then I was kind of surprised when Loyola offered me a position, because having very little background in basic science was something I thought was going to be taken very seriously. But yeah, it turned out and here I am.
That's awesome. And what was that first meeting with Jonathan like? Was it his research that really interested you, or his personality, or a little bit of both?
Yeah, I know it's kind of surprising, because having interviewed for other programs and then having been with Jonathan, I was expecting to kind of be grilled on my background and my my research, you know. But it certainly was not the case. It was more of just like a conversation for 45 minutes, just talking about like things to do in Chicago and like fun studies that Jonathan had done recently and was excited to get off in his lab. And this is, he's a young PI now, but he was maybe 3 years in then, or 2 years in. And he was so excited and optimistic, and just the research was interesting. And I came to Loyola thinking I was going to do cardiovascular research, but the thing that made the difference wasn't necessarily the research. I think he's just an incredibly optimistic person, which I think as a PI, to be successful, you kind of have to be, because science can be a lot of negative data and a lot of trial and error. So I think it was more his optimism and just like clear passion for what he's doing. So I think that was it.
I love that. I love that Jonathan's optimism and personality, sort of helped to steer you into research. I think that's something that a lot of trainees might not appreciate. Like you said, you were surprised to get the offer, but as a new PI myself, a young PI, also all PIs love being called young. So when Jonathan listens back, he'll be very
He'll
happy to send
appreciate it.
a But I'm always looking for personality too, and people that you get along with. And I think that was probably, he probably left that interview going, "Man, that Tommy is great." So I love that.
So, Tommy, I think you're selling yourself a little bit short because I'm sure Jonathan interviewed other people as well, and he chose you. Cannot just be the personality. So, tell us, how did you sell yourself in this interview? I think that's very important for trainees. Even though you're saying you just came in there and it was just a conversation, you had to have some background or ideas, or you showed something that made Jonathan choose you.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I guess maybe it's not total chance that I ended up here. No, I think I was very honest with what I was expecting out of graduate school and also out of a potential advisor. I'm saying basically, I will work very hard to learn, the things I'm not very good at yet, like the basic science bench work that I just didn't have experience with coming in. But I think I made it clear that my interests were in cardiovascular research generally, and that I had a good background clinically. And with Jonathan, he's very interested in like fundamental like biophysical questions of like the sarcomere and muscle contraction, but also of translating that to human patients. So I think kind of coming from a non-traditional background myself, but having an idea of like the end goal, like patient-centered research, I think coming together with his background in the kind of biophysics and bioengineering, I think it became a nice kind of complement where we both came from slightly different areas that maybe both of us being considered like a non-traditional route to academia with our research and training background. But I think it worked out very well that kind of the idea between both of us that was kind of synergized was like translatability of the science. And I think anyone can learn the fundamental like molecular biology techniques or whatever you need to do to be successful in the graduate school. But I think coming in with a very clear, like dead set mindset of wanting to like further my understanding of cardiovascular research and science was something that probably stood out to him.
You said a lot of important information right now in your answer. First, you told him you were willing to work really hard. That's something every advisor, every PI expects. You wanted to learn new things, especially all the techniques that you were not familiar with. So you showed that you're going to be a very curious and forward and active thinker. So that's really important. And you had a clear idea of what you wanted to do, which many people, when you're a trainee, many times you do not know. You just know you're interested in research. So you already even knew what you wanted to do, and you had a clinical background. So it was a win-win-win situation. And now, obviously, after you told us this and we look at your manuscript, we can see that you did exactly what you had told him that you would like to do some translational work. So can you tell us about the work that you published in AJP Heart?
Yeah, I guess for a little background, my dissertation project kind of became centered around this protein called BAG3, which is a co-chaperone protein expressed really in most tissues, pretty highly involved in protein quality control processes such as autophagy, et cetera. But we were interested in this protein from a kind of a clinical perspective in the sense of it had been shown in the literature that BAG3 mutations, genetic mutations in BAG3 were associated with heart failure, specifically dilated cardiomyopathies. And there was also a bit of evidence that, generally speaking, BAG3 protein expression was down in disease. So we thought to kind of further study the protein in a larger patient cohort, if you will. So it's obviously very difficult to do human subjects research at a basic science level because just the availability of tissue is limited. But fortunately, at Loyola, we have a biobank in the Cardiovascular Research Institute that has a bunch of human heart tissue from either explants or from non-failing tissue that wasn't used for a transplant for whatever reason. So going into that, we were like, okay, well, can we look into this protein, BAG3, in the human non-failing and dilated cardiomyopathy samples and first look at just generally protein expression in this really large cohort will that still suggest a decrease in expression? But more than that, we were also interested in sarcomere function and sarcomere protein quality control. And we had other data in a different paper that had shown that BAG3 was important for sarcomere function. So we thought to look at basically BAG3 expression specifically in the sarcomeric protein pool where it's known to localize and see if that might be impacted by disease. But then not only by disease, since we had this large cohort of patients, 19 non-failing and 25 DCM patients, we thought, okay, maybe we can also look at sex differences potentially, which had also been found for mutations, but we really had no idea if there were sex differences in like localization or expression of the protein.
Well, and I made note of those sex differences, Tommy, and you better believe that I was like, I'm going to be the one to snipe this sex differences question. So do you want to tell us what you found in terms of sex differences?
We looked specifically in the left ventricle of these samples. We didn't do any RV or atria studies, but in the left ventricle, the whole tissue expression levels, there were really not any differences or sex differences in expression of BAG3. However, when we looked specifically in this sarcomere protein pool of BAG3, what we did find is that in male patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, there was about a 50% reduction in BAG3 protein expression at the sarcomere. However, in the females, there was really no difference between the non-failing females and the DCM females. So this was important to us because I think generally speaking, in people who have done studies on BAG3, especially in mouse models, a lot of it has been done just in male mice. And I think we're probably missing a really large aspect of, you know, obviously a sex difference that just hasn't been studied at all in the literature, especially the basic science mouse studies. So this finding that in the sarcomere specific pool of the protein, that in the females, for whatever reason, it's a maintained localization, even in heart failure, whereas in the males, it was reduced, I think could be an important insight for future studies who are kind of investigating both the mechanisms regulating BAG3's localization to the sarcomere, which it would suggest the females obviously have sustained that mechanism for whatever reason in heart failure, whereas the males seem to lose whatever that was.
And I know that you found similar expression in BAG3 in the healthy hearts, I believe is what I read. What do you think all of this means, though, that the expression was associated with DCM in the males, not the females? In terms of BAG3's role in female, like, do you think under healthy conditions, it's doing something different or is more or less important between the sexes? Or do you think it's really just a difference in disease states?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we tried to explore a little bit using a rat overreactivity model with estrogen replacement acutely to see if perhaps it was estrogen dependent, which is obviously just a small aspect of potential sex differences. We didn't see anything there. My assumption, and obviously we don't have a ton of data to support this, is that it's only a difference that's coming out in disease. It's a disease dependent difference that's specific to the males. And I say that based on two things. And one important study that we cite in this paper was a clinical study of, I think, like 129 patients with BAG3 mutations. And what they found is that with BAG3 mutations, a similar thing is observed where mutations have a much higher disease penetrance in male patients, but not in female patients. So that for whatever reasons, the females appear to be protected against BAG3 mutations. And then on the other hand, they also appear to maintain BAG3 levels at the sarcomere when the males were losing it. So as far as the mechanism of why that is, we're still unsure, but it does appear to be a disease-dependent difference. And I do believe that the role of BAG3 might be the same between the male and female patients, but whatever the case is in DCM for the males, there's a, I think somewhere in whatever signaling pathway we haven't identified yet is disrupted in the males.
Very interesting.
So I'm curious about something. As you said, BAG3 is expressed in several tissues, and it has been associated with heart failure for a while, so people have looked a little bit at it. Has anyone studied the effect of current heart failure medications in the protein expression of BAG3? And so that's the first part of the question. And because sometimes women are given different medication than males, could it be possible that the medication they're taking could also somehow be not completely explain, but be part of the explanation for this X difference?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. Definitely. I think one of the limitations with the study, and there's obviously a lot of limitations when you do studies in human samples, is that we don't know a whole lot about the individual samples because they're de-identified tissue. We know general characteristics, male, female, ethnicity, ejection fraction, but we don't know a whole lot of outside of that with medications. And for example, if in the female samples, there was estrogen replacement therapy, for example, we were not aware of those types of things. So I think that is an important question. Like, what is the effect of generally heart failure medications on BAG3 protein expression? And to answer your first question, have there been any studies done to assess that? Definitely not yet. Now, there's, I think, relatively few basic science studies of BAG3. There's been a wealth of clinical evidence showing that, like, the relationship between mutations in BAG3 and heart failure. But so far, there hasn't been a whole lot of basic science research into BAG3. And certainly not yet are we at a point where people are studying the effects of various heart failure medications on BAG3 protein levels and expression. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't have an effect, of course. I think it's going to be important to look into that. And perhaps that does help to explain some of those differences in expression and localization.
And Tommy, did you want to talk a little bit about the potential effect of severity of DCM on what happens to BAG3? Because I noticed you said that you didn't observe as big a drop in BAG3 as this previous study had, this Feldman study, and that you thought that might have something to do with severity or ischemic versus non-ischemic DCM. So did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So the study you mentioned by Dr. Feldman at Temple, they had shown in a bit of a smaller cohort that BAG3 levels decreased, and they had in their failing hearts group both ischemic cardiomyopathy and dilated cardiomyopathy, and they found a really robust decrease. It was something like 80% decrease at the protein level. And in our sample as well, there was a decrease in the sarcomere-specific protein pool that was about pretty fairly reduced and highly significant. But in the whole tissue, the whole LV, we didn't see the same thing that Dr. Feldman had seen, where they saw a really robust decrease. And we saw a trending toward a decrease, but certainly not as robust. And yeah, our explanation was perhaps it's the severity of the disease, where the samples from Dr. Feldman's study had, I think, a bit more severe of a heart failure. Certainly systolic function was more severely depressed compared to our samples. So why that is the case, we're not so sure. One thing that seems to be consistent between all the studies that we've done, as well as Dr. Feldman's studies, is that protein stability of BAG3 seems to be the issue, because it's not a change in gene expression usually. So if you look at the Feldman study, they show that by qPCR, gene expression levels are maintained in the heart failure group, while they saw basically a complete decrease, almost an absence of BAG3 at the protein level. So wherever the disconnect is, it seems to be regulating BAG3's protein stability, either because the protein is unstable and it's being quickly degraded for whatever reason, or if it's just being turned over too fast and maybe not enough is being made in the heart failure setting. We're not totally sure, but I think it does come down to a mechanism that regulates BAG3 stability. And we assume that in the most severe cases of heart failure, that is also being severely impacted.
And you mentioned when you were answering Char that not only you did all this work using your patient samples, you also did a rat study with over-optimized rats. So for me, it's really nice to see that a trainee has this type of exposure. So you learn all these different techniques. You not only dealt with patient samples, you also did animal model system. And you're telling me that you looked at autophagy influx. So you learn a lot of these different molecular biology and biochemical techniques. So my question is, during your training, what was the most technically challenging approach that you had to learn?
I think there were a few, for sure. You mentioned how having the various aspects of training is important. And I will say, just to plug Jonathan's lab as if he needs it, that was a great thing about being in his lab, is that the breadth of techniques that you could learn and the various models that you can use from going from human tissue to animal models down to cell models really was a great environment to train in for that reason, kind of getting very good exposure. The most difficult type of technique that I had to use, I didn't use for the AJP paper, but if you just talk about in general, a technique that was challenging, it was proteomics. I think not a lot of people go into grad school with a
my baby
in mass spectrometry. Yeah. So I think specifically mass spectrometry in Jonathan's lab, it was great because you get to learn every aspect of proteomics, both from the preparation of samples at the bench, you know, generating peptides, learning how to desalt these samples. And then beyond that, to the instrumentation level. So we are very lucky to have a Orbitrap mass spectrometer within the department, and Jonathan's the director of that core. So yeah, being in his lab to learn that technique is, I think, very rare, to also have the molecular biology background, but then to be doing mass spectrometry as well. That was the most difficult thing though, because a lot goes into mass spec, and I think that was a hurdle for a little while, but certainly I feel comfortable doing it now.
I'm glad you realize how lucky you are as a trainee to be exposed to this breadth of approaches. It's awesome. I'm very happy for you. It really is.
It's been a great experience. I mean, going in, maybe not realizing or being thankful during the learning processes, but certainly looking back, you can be thankful and be like, wow, I certainly got a good training in this lab.
So Tommy, this is the moment that we've all been waiting for. We want you to dish on Jonathan. What's it like? You said a lot of wonderful things. What's it like to work in the lab? What's the lab like? What's Jonathan like? Can you tell the world a little known fact about Jonathan Kirk?
Like, do people like his beard? What's up with the beard?
Yeah, that's a lot of good questions. Well, let's start with the beard. He likes the beard. I don't think the beard's going anywhere. But I don't know.
Guess if that's all that counts.
Yeah, no, that's very important. As long as he's happy, we're happy.
Exactly.
So he kind of organizes our CVRI, our Cardiovascular Research Institute, goes to the AHA Heart Walk every year in Chicago. And last year, if we reached a certain goal of funding, he was going to shave his head. So then we reached the goal, of course. And so Jonathan was bald with the beard, and really it was quite the semblance. Yeah. So
I'll send
some pictures maybe. Yeah. It was a look.
Oh, you have to send pictures.
They'll come along. Yeah. He has his own picture on a mug now that he brings to lab meeting. The picture of him bald with a beard. So he's flattering himself for sure. But
awesome.
So a good look. But it's been great in Jonathan's lab, but he is a very hands-off PI and allows his trainees to kind of learn as they go and be independent, which is honestly going on to a postdoc after this, a great training environment to learn in. He's very available if you need help, but he's not going to hold your hand as you go through the process of kind of stumbling along and figuring your way out in graduate school. So he's really lets you kind of run the show as far as your project goes, which is really nice. And on its own is a good training technique, I think, to kind of learn as an independent scientist. So that's been really nice. I mentioned before, he's optimistic. I don't know how he's so optimistic, because he always seems to be. He's very passionate about his projects in his lab, and he has a diverse interests. They all kind of come back to the sarcomere, but I feel like we have so many projects that he's interested in. His optimism is forever.
How is he in the morning before his coffee?
You know,
is he still optimistic?
I don't think he lets us see us. You know, he doesn't come to see us until he's in that mindset. So we don't really catch him too early.
That's a life hack right there.
See, that's maybe the way to do it. Yeah. The only day we see him early is we have lab meetings Tuesday morning, and we see him at 8:30. But even by then, I think he's had a cup. So it used to be the only time he would come to lab is to come hang out and drink our coffee. That is something I'm now realizing. Since COVID, it's been a little different. But
you must have made a good cup, or else he wouldn't have come back.
Yeah. It was great coffee.
So tell me, you had obviously a great experience through your PhD, and you had a great advisor, a great mentor, and I'm sure he is, mentoring you while you go through the hassle, because it can be a hassle of interviewing and preparing for your postdoc. So as a trainee, what are you looking for on your postdoc advisor, and which tips or advice would you tell your fellow colleagues of how they should prepare for these interviews?
Yeah, so I think it might be specific to interests and kind of future career goals. But I was looking for, so Jonathan's lab it's been anywhere from like 5 to 8 people while I've been there, which is a good size and a great place to learn as a PhD student. But I wanted to go to a bigger lab for my postdoc. So I was looking for a larger group than I'd been in currently, but then more specifically to work in a lab that had techniques that I wasn't familiar with, something where I could kind of advance my training. I didn't want to study the same protein, even though bacteria has been great to study and I've had a lot of fun doing it. I wanted to kind of branch out, stay within the heart and cardiovascular research, but move on to some techniques that were new, a new protein of interest, things like that I could like broaden my scientific, I guess, applicability, things I could learn that wouldn't just be kind of going through the motions of the same things I did in my PhD. So that was a big one. But as far as the things that I think helped the most in preparing for the interview, probably it would have been the talk. I think anyone can do a Western blot or a lot of the molecular biology techniques that are expected of basic science researchers. And I think any lab's going to have people who can do those things. So what I felt like I contributed the most during my interviews was during my talk, my seminar, I felt like I did a fairly good job and communicated the ideas very clearly. And I think that the labs I was interviewing with saw that. They saw that I really understood fundamentally the content, the research, the background of my project. I think those are the things that were the most important. I didn't think it was any specific paper that made me well qualified for a certain lab. Like, oh, I have this paper, I did this, so now you should hire me. I think it was going in and giving the talk. And I think that maybe stood out. Them realizing I had a very clear understanding of not just what I've done, but of the whole area of BAG3 research kind of since the protein was identified. I think that was important, just kind of the preparation over the years.
That's such a wonderful point, Tommy. And I think I didn't really have that kind of confidence you're describing when I finished my PhD. And it was only when I started postdocing and people kept on introducing me as an expert. They'd say, oh, we have an expert on neurovascular regulation. I go, oh, really? Who's here? And they'd be like, no, you. I'm like, oh, and I wasn't super comfortable, but it sounds like your lab has done a great job and Jonathan's done, and you've done a great job in preparing you and sort of giving you that confidence in your well-earned, you know, ability and expertise. So it sounds like you're ready to head into your new positions as the expert that you are. That makes me really happy to hear.
I appreciate that. Yeah, being called an expert will be something that takes a little adjusting to, I think.
So Tommy, I'm going to assume that you went back and listened to my grand entrance to Behind the Bench where I was interviewed. I'm just kidding. Anyway, on that, your wonderful supervisor asked me some questions at the end of the podcast. Not remembering what he asked me, I've come up with my own questions. So we're going to rapid fire you.
Brilliant.
Number one, what's your hometown?
It's hard to say, actually. I guess I can go with Jackson, Michigan. Now, my parents moved a lot when I was young. So
right.
Michigan generally, let's go with that.
And does your hometown have a claim to fame?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, if you go to Ann Arbor, which is just next door, there's a great claim to fame, University of Michigan.
Great. Okay. Next question, switching gears. How many drafts, if you remember, or you can ballpark it, did this paper go through before you submitted it to the journal?
Probably 4.
Oh, wow.
Four, wow. Yeah.
Only?
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Jonathan and I apparently have the same writing style. That's his words, not mine. So I think he generally will agree and just like make a few changes before he sends it back to me. So,
okay. Heartfelt question time. Who are your heroes or who is your hero? It can be science hero, life hero. You can name more than one.
That's a great question. Yeah. My hero is probably my older brother. If he ever listens to this, he's going to cry. But he certainly is. He's 2 years older than me. We lived in the same room for like 20 years growing up. So definitely my hero. He's not a scientist. He's a automotive design guy for GM. Definitely him.
Okay, that was beautiful. Okay, if you quit academia tomorrow, what career would you pursue?
Oh, I love this question. Wow. See, I wish I was very talented at other things. If I could pick anything and assume I'd be good at it, I would either want to be a violinist. I play violin. Intermediate level quality, or an Olympic distance runner, because I'm also a runner at Brandon College. So one of those two things, but I'm not nearly talented enough to do it. So
oh, cool.
If I had to be realistic, I want to be a waiter at an Italian restaurant. It's my dream.
Would you sing opera? Like, what would be your shtick? Like, would you?
I would play the violin, of course.
Oh, right. Right.
That's perfect.
Well, my husband is a violin. Well, he was professionally violin player. So now cool. He does other stuff. So I can say it's very charming.
Stephanie and I met in an undergrad. And in undergrad, I was so busy with other things. I had like forgotten about violin for a bit. I played from like the age of 6 to 17 and then didn't play in undergrad. And I picked up and did graduate school. As a second person who inspires me, it has to be her. The fact of like going through the graduate school thing as a, you know, partner who isn't doing it, but tries to be supportive and to understand it. God, that's gotta be tough as well.
Oh, I assume she's showing up in your thesis acknowledgements.
Oh, right? Yeah. The most important name there for sure.
Love it. Okay. And my last question is, what is your superpower? And by superpower, I mean, you know, I've got two. One, that I can sleep anywhere, anytime, and I sleep like crazy. And I have excellent eyesight that I brag about incessantly. So with that as the backdrop, what is your superpower?
Yeah, that's great. I used to say the eyesight one, but then I did a lot of microscopy in graduate school and now I wear glasses. So I lost that superpower in graduate school, sadly. It's a disclaimer for first year students. Watch your eyes. Superpower for me, probably, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure on that one.
You know, that's very humble of you. And now that I brag that I have two superpowers, I think your humility is a superpower that I'm really in awe of. So I'll try to learn from you, Tommy.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. You sound great.
Tommy, you were a pleasure to interview. Thank you so much for joining us and for indulging us with all the Jonathan information. That was priceless. And this was Behind the Bench, episode 10.
Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart. Hey, listeners, this is Kara. We were just wrapping up our conversation with Tommy Martin when we got a pretty exclusive scoop on Jonathan Kirk's nickname. So keep listening. That's the first time I've ever heard you call him John.
Oh, this, no, we got to put this in the podcast. Okay. Fun thing about
we can move stuff around.
Him John? I thought he was just going by Jonathan.
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Okay.
Let's no discuss. Way. Let's.
So, okay. So when I joined the lab, it was me and this other student who had been a technician for him. And we were some of his first PhD students. And what he told us is like, when he asked what to call him, he's like, call me Jonathan, unless I'm going to get hit by a bus, then call me John. So that could be quick, you know, get him out of the situation. You know, so if he's about to get hit by a car, John is good because it's short and quick, but otherwise it's Jonathan. So for the longest time, he's using Jonathan for sure. And I think he still definitely prefers for us to call him Jonathan. Mm-hmm. But as we've progressed in our graduate school years and, you know, with any PI, sometimes you're frustrated with them. And
oh yeah,
that, it's just a natural way when you're like a fourth or fifth year PhD student. And we've progressed now.
You just looked over your shoulder.
It used to be just between us that we would say, oh, the John, oh, John. But it's progressed over. This is like 2 years ago. We started calling him John to each other when we were like upset with him. Oh, John, John asked for this. He got wise to it a little bit, maybe overheard a conversation. So now if we're like trying to be funny, but also like take him off a little bit, just call him John. Hey, John, got this for you, John. Here's some data, John.
Next time I'll see him. obviously, our relationship hasn't moved forward because I still call you Jonathan.
Yeah, it's time to move to John. He'll love it.
We need to move to John.
Or he just never annoyed you, Liz. He was always just perfect with you. So you never had any need. And you didn't have to save him from any buses.
Yeah, that's key. That's key. That's.
It's almost dangerous that I have this piece of information because I now have, I'm at a fork in the road. Right. I mean, it all comes back around to my intro because I know that's the most important part here. But, you know,
you have to work with him a lot.
Right. And I have 7 other associate editors who are going to be like, what's that now? They're going to lean in a little bit. I feel
like him on his toes.
Oh, can we now do that?
Spice it in there now and then accidentally call him John.
I think I'm going to hold on to it until like I really need to play that card and then going to go down.
That's great.
Then I'll say, you're about to be hit by the bus, John.
John, I call us.
love it. Thank you all. Totally awesome. Appreciate it.
See you guys.
Bye. Bye.